Welcome to episode 311 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. I'm your host, Ian Martin, and today we're going to be finding out about the ski resort of Sumpaluk in Italy, what it's like heli skiing in Albania, and we've got my report from the last day of skiing here in Chamonix. We also have snow reports from that last day at Grand Monte, plus Cervinia in Italy and Les des Alpes and Tignes in France. Right, let's meet today's guests. My first guest returns for her fourth appearance on the show. She's previously shared her experience of touring the Alps in a camper van. That was in episode 167. The Oat Route in episode 172. And Yalo in Norway in episode 204. I'm delighted to welcome back freelance journalist Katie Bamba. Hi, Katie. How are you?
Hi there. I'm good, thanks.
Cool. And whereabouts are you today, Katie?
I'm in London today. I've just got back from Austria. I went to the Kitzsteinhorn for a couple of days and I just got back.
Fantastic. Well, I guess we'll hear about that in a minute or two. I was kind of surprised that my second guest has only been on the podcast once before. That was also in episode 172, and he joined Katie to share his thoughts on the Oat Route. So joining us today for his second appearance, freelance journalist and editor of Snow Magazine, Tris Kennedy. Hi, Tris. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Thanks, Ian.
And whereabouts are you?
I'm at home in, which is Trento, which is in the Italian Dolomites.
Ah, cool. How's it looking out the window today?
It's a little bit rainy. The last of the snow on the piece that I can see out my window has sort of melted away. They shut the lifts about 3-4 weeks ago in the little resorts that sit above town. And the rain that's fallen recently has just sort of slowly been melting the remaining bits of snow.
That is the end of the season.
Very much so.
The snow disappearing. Although, ironically, as I say that, I am currently in Chamonix. I look out the window and the snow line is down to about 1,800 meters this morning. You know, it's only a dusting at that level. But, you know, for those people who've got a season pass, they'll be going up to the Aiguille de Midi, I'm sure, as soon as it clears up to get a bit of extra skiing in. Thinking that, a question I always like to ask my guests is, when did you ski or snowboard last? Katie, I think you've given the game away already. When was that?
I got back on Saturday, so it was the 1st of May, a few days around the 1st of May, so definitely out of regular ski season. And I was staying in Zellamsee, which is about 20 minutes drive from the glacier. So Caprone is the town and the Kitzsteinhorn is the glacier. And it was about 22 degrees in the valley, so it was, you know, proper summer weather. And then headed up onto the glacier and had 2 days of pure sunshine, and there was one snow day as well.
How were conditions on the glacier then?
I love late spring skiing anyway, but up at the top, it was, you know, kind of hard-packed pieces. I don't think I got on the snow before 11 a.m., and they were still, you know, hard-packed, wide-open groomers. And then further down you travel, I kind of, you know, hit it later in the day. I mean, I did an hour or two skiing because I had a one-year-old with me. So I only managed to squeeze in a few runs here and there, but it, you know, it got that, it was that kind of granular corn snow, which I love. You know, it kind of holds you up when you're snowboarding. Slightly better for snowboarding than skiing, I think, later in the day. But yeah, it was great.
Yeah, for sure. At this time of year, I think having a wider base, whether it's ski or snowboard, really works on those spring conditions. And I guess the other side of things, you know, I'll come to the skiing I've done more recently, but at this time of year, it's all about timing it, isn't it? You're going to hit the right facing slope at the right time of day to try and get it in the perfect condition. You don't want to be on that boilerplate stuff early on. You want to get it when it's softened up. And Tris, what about yourself? When were you last on snow?
On Friday, actually. And that was a kind of one-off. The nearest resort close to us here with any kind of serious altitude is Passo Tonale. So the resort is at 1,800 meters and the lifts go up to 3,000 and they keep their lifts open. They would have shut their lifts on Sunday, so the 3rd of May. And I wanted to squeeze in one last day. It was a morning, really, partly just to get a last sort of kick out of the season, but also I get sent stuff to test. Part of my job as editor of Snow. There were two snowboards that arrived quite late in the season that I hadn't had a chance to get out and test, and a new follow cam drone as well. So I chucked all those in the car, got up quite early and got up there, and then was doing kind of like one run, changing board, taking the drone up, trying something like that. So it was a little bit of a bitty day, but surprisingly good conditions. One of the boards was a split board and one was a powder board, and I managed to find a bit of powder that had kind of stayed in the shade on a north-facing slope that felt quite good.
What a joy. Regular listeners will know that I've been based in Chamonix for the last couple of months. It really has been such a joy to spend a sustained period of time here. To quote one of my favourite movies, life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it. I love the mountains. Hopefully that comes across in these podcasts. My first day skiing this season on the 16th of December in St. Anton, and my last day, probably, unless I kind of trek to Tiene or something like that, was last Sunday on the 3rd of May for the closing day of the season at Grandmonte. And, you know, the snow, depending how you want to look at it, was either not that good or absolutely brilliant, considering it was the 3rd of May. And like Katie, there are a lot of spring conditions there. It is generally north-facing in the Grandmonte. There's still a lot of snow up there, but it was pretty soft overall. But across the day, what a fantastic day out, that closing day party they have there in the Grandmonte. You know, I'd never been before. I've done ski seasons before, but I don't remember having an end-of-season party quite like this. So let's have a listen to a bit of audio recorded on the hill that will hopefully give you sense of the atmosphere.
So closing day at the Grandmonte, last skiing of the season in Chamonix on the 3rd of May. There is such a celebratory atmosphere here. There's DJs, there's barbecues, there's massive queues for food. There's face painting for the kids, there's a little zip wire, and back over there, the famous water slide. Really is just a fun day. I think a lot of families are here, a lot of people who live here all year round. I'm not sure there are many holiday makers. It's been a real pleasure to be able to be part of it. What a great way to sign up the season.
Sad to say I didn't try the pond skin myself, but it was brilliant fun watching it. You can check it out too. I've posted a couple of videos on YouTube, but I'll link to that in the show notes. Tris, I think you told me in the green room earlier that you have been to a pond skin. Did you try it yourself?
Yes, I did, but kind of the smallest bit of the pond, and made it successfully across and was like, right, I'm done. That's it. I'm fine. I don't need to try anything else here.
I'm still very impressed with your courage for going across it. The pool, as you'll see if you look at the videos in the Grandmonte, had been dug out and created by the team there. It was, I guess, relatively short, but long enough for me not to want to give it a go. Now, there aren't many places left for skiing in Europe, but some of our reporters have been on snow in the last week. So let's hear what they have to say about the latest snow conditions. We've got Alex Almond from Tip Top Ski Coaching in Ladiesout. Floss Cockle from the YouTube channel Free Flow Floss is in Tiene. And Dave Burrows from Snow Pro Ski School was in Chavinia.
Hi, this is Alex from Tip Top Ski Coaching, here with the snow report from Ladiesout. Out on the piste at the start of the spring ski season, and the conditions are absolutely fantastic. We're skiing down to 2,600 metres with no problem at all. A piste as if it were winter. Absolutely brilliant. Blue skies, sunshine, perfect conditions. The resort is open until the beginning of July, so please do come and join us on the slopes during May, June or early July.
Hi, this is Floss from Free Flow Ski reporting from the Tarentaise Valley, which includes the ski resorts of Lézarc, Tiene, Val d'Isère, La Rosière and Saint-Foy. Now, what an amazing last week of the season. I really had doubts after following a great week in Val Thorens. I returned back to Tiene and Val d'Isère, and the slopes were so quiet. We were looking at about 37% capacity full on both resorts of Val and also Tiene. Now, the weather was so much better than expected. We had bright blue skies, really stable conditions, just epic, quite pieced. Now, the conditions on the piste were quite normal for that time of year. Temperatures had risen up, so it's 5 degrees at 8 o'clock at 2,000 metres and warming up. The melt freeze, however, was a little bit higher than average, and it came into around 2,800 metres, 2,900. So not every night we had an absolute amazing freeze fall, but we did have some really good conditions. On the piste, with no one around, it was dead. It was amazing, so quiet. From 9 o'clock to 1 o'clock, you could really blast around the piste. About 89% of all areas were open, and you had no one around. So what can I say? What an amazing season it's been. It's been a season of extremes. Great weather, then wind. We've had some four massive snowstorms throughout the winter. So wishing everyone a happy summer. I hope you all had a great winter, and I look forward to hearing from you soon.
Hi Ian, it's Dave from Snowpro Ski School. Hope you and all the listeners are doing great. On Saturday, I was in Chavinia, the ski area that links over into Zermatt. I went over there for the, I've got a bit of a project going, myself and my daughter. So we're trying to ski from where I live here in Switzerland, in the Porte du Soleil. You can ski every month of the year. So I've kind of got a semi-ambitious project to try and ski every single month of the calendar year. So this winter season, I started November the 8th. And part of that project was I noticed that the Chavinia was open on, well, its closing date for the main ski area was Sunday, 3rd of May. So we went up there for the weekend and skied there on Saturday. Second, conditions were absolutely amazing. So like hard winter, like snow in the morning, going on to the usual kind of afternoon slush as the temperature went up, and that sort of glorious golden hour or two if you hit the right kind of slopes around sort of 10:30, 11 o'clock. Had an absolutely brilliant time. It was fantastic. It's one of my favorite ski areas. The slopes there are incredible. It's the place that I choose to go if I ever get a choice to go skiing. So it's absolutely fantastic. Like I said, the main ski area there closes on Sunday, or closed on Sunday, and now they're into sort of summer mode. So you can access the glacier, the Monte Rosa Glacier, that sort of sits between Zermatt and Chavinia. The project continues. I've got a couple of weekend windows of opportunity in June, and that's me kind of semi-finished for the season, full 6 month season, and now it will be just trying to grab those opportunities over the summer. So hope you're all well anyway, and I'll give you a summer snow report when I'm skiing in June. See you later, bye.
So our apartment here in Chamonix looks out over Mont Blanc, and pretty much first thing I do every day is pick up the binoculars to see who's on the mountain today. And weather's been a bit rubbish this week, but I can normally see tourers going up from the Grand Moulet hut or from the Cusmeet refuge towards Mont Blanc du Tacul, or climbers taking on the Mallory route on the north face of the Aiguille du Midi. It really does amaze me every time when I like picking out these tiny ants crawling all over the mountains. And as time has passed, I've worked out where to look out for them. All those adventures are super impressive. But a week last Saturday, and I'll try and get these names right, Samuel Equi and Matteo Giacomo set a new ski FKT, and that is fastest known time, for Chamonix to the top of Mont Blanc and back. They did that in just 4 hours, 41 minutes and 21 seconds. It's almost just impossible to get your head around what that means. They start from the church in Chamonix. They run until they hit the snow, and then they tour, clipping in, skiing as much as they can on the way back before running back to hit the door of the church, and they stop the clock. I'm going to put a link to the show notes, and you can watch their video. One of the reasons I have you both, Katie and Tris, on the show today is before I came to Chamonix, I re-listened to episode 172. When both of you join me to talk about the Haute Route.
Well, I can also tell you that this was his second record that Giacomo broke, as earlier in April, he set a time of 13 hours, 27 minutes for the Haute Route.
And that is Chamonix to Zermatt, 103 kilometres. Normally takes 5 to 6 days or so. You've both, you know, done the Haute Route, different variations of it. Tris, did you want to say something about their achievements?
I mean, just absolutely mind-blowing doing that, which, as you said, normally takes 6 days in 13 hours is absolutely insane. And I've seen footage of the guys doing it on Instagram, and, I mean, the speed they're moving, it's a bit like watching Sebastian Sorway, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, run the London Marathon, as he did recently, and breaking the kind of famed two-hour barrier. You look at them and you're like, okay, I could probably sprint at your ski mountaineering pace for maybe a couple of hundred meters. Same with Sebastian Sorway, who's running 17 second 100 meters or whatever. And you're like, okay, I could keep up with you for 100 meters, but you guys are doing that for 13 hours. This is, it's that level of athleticism.
Yeah, it's insane, isn't it? Katie, you were on the show back in 172 talking about the Oat Route. And actually, I've mentioned one of the comments that you made during that to a few people where I think you said you got sunburn on the back of your hands when you were doing that. But I wondered if you had any thoughts about, you know, that kind of record, being able to do the Oat Route in 13 hours.
Yeah, I think that's a good quote of mine to bring up, because my lasting, it's obviously been a lot longer since when we spoke about it, but my lasting memories, apart from the dramatic scenery, is just how hot it was. And we were only touring at snail's pace from like 4 or 5 in the morning to perhaps 11. So it wasn't even the heat of the day, but doing a sprint for a longer period is incredible.
Yeah, these guys are unbelievably fit. And I believe that because the combination of a reasonable amount of late snow and then sort of warmer, favourable weather during late April meant that it was really good time to be able to do that record. And in fact, the women's record was broken twice last month as well. So a new record was set early in the month, and I think only like 4 days later it was broken again. So maybe it'll happen again this winter. We'll see. I haven't interviewed these guys, but I have been speaking to a lot of people while I've been here in Chamonix. I'm going to be releasing a special episode in the next few weeks in which I'm going to try and sum up why Chamonix is such a special place. So the only problem is with that is I've ended up with too many great stories to fit into one episode. So I'm going to share some of my interviews with different Chamonix personalities and businesses through the summer. Right. That's all to come. I'd like to move on to you now, Katie, if I could. Now, as a crow fly, Champalook is not that far away from where I am now, but perhaps we could start if you could explain where it is.
Sure. So it's in the Aosta Valley, which is in the very northwest corner of Italy, closest to the Swiss border, but also really close to France as well. So I flew to Turin and then drove for an hour and a half, but it's also an hour and a half's drive from the Italian side of the Mont Blanc tunnel. So you can drive in 10 to 13 hours from the UK as well. And you can also fly to Milan, where it's a couple of hours drive from the airport. So pretty accessible.
Yeah, I think that actually the only time I've been to that area, when I skied in Champalook, I went to Alagna, links over, I think, via Monte Rosa. And we went to Milan on that particular trip there. When were you there?
So that was mid-December. So I've skied twice in Europe this season at both ends of winter. And it's been amazing snow on both ends, actually. But a small resort like Champalook, not on snow, but for village-wise, it was potentially a little too early in the season to go, just for buses running and to have all of the, you know, shops and restaurants open.
But you went in mid-December, and what was the snow like at that time? I think it was a good start to the season early on.
It was incredible snow, yeah. So I did it as a family trip. It was the first time I've organised a family ski trip. My usual MO is to kind of go as far away, but more obscure with not a lot going on is usually what I like. So it was the first time organising a ski trip with my partner, who's a relatively new skier, and my one-year-old and my parents. So it was a full-on family trip. So instead of...
It was one of those three generational trips, which I believe are coming more and more common. And hopefully that enabled you to get some extra time on the mountain. What was it? What would you say the ski area is like then?
Yeah, so Champalook is part of the Monte Rosa ski area. So that's kind of the Alpine Three Valleys. So you've got Champalook is in the westernmost valley, and then it links over to Gressonay, and then Alagna is the third valley.
I remember I was in Alagna, and now Gressonay and Champalook, it all makes sense. And from my recollection, there's a real mix of skiing there, because we tended to ski around where it joins with Alagna, and at the higher end of the area, there's some really good kind of free ride terrain. But overall, that area offers something for all abilities.
So it's pitched often as a family ski area, and I really do get the appeal for as a family ski area. The price point is really good. It's Italian hospitality. The snow was in such good condition. I mean, there was just so much snow everywhere. And also, so I was staying in Champalook, which I think is probably the biggest village. I wouldn't say it's massively lively. It's like a good, honest, authentic ski resort, I would say, but it's the biggest of the three. In Champalook, it's almost exclusively red runs. So I went, and my husband went up the lifts, and I forgot to check the piece map. It wasn't, like I said, I checked kind of drive times before I checked like snow forecast before we booked this trip. So the snow was great, but it's red runs. And so you get the cable car from Champoluc up to Crest, and there's a really nice high nursery slope there with amazing scenery. So if you are total beginner, you could go up, but I would say beyond a couple of days, there's no real progression from real beginner to I would say strong intermediate. And then I think from strong intermediate, it's probably one of the best ski areas I've ever been to.
And you mentioned there's lots of red runs. You know, every resort seems to have their own definition of red runs. Some of them are in the Chamonix area, are more like what you might come across as blacks in other resorts. These are advanced intermediate or strong intermediate reds, you're saying, yeah?
I think the terrain is quite engaging. There's no kind of up-down groomer. You know, there's no wide motorway groomers that you might find in beginner-friendly resorts like Valcharens, for example. They kind of like wrap around the mountain. So you're getting a good like scenic ski as you go. And for someone who didn't ski as much as they usually would on a ski trip, I feel like you get quite a lot bang for your buck. You know, it's just beautiful skiing.
Yeah. And did you get to explore that free ride area that I seem to recall from my previous trip?
Unfortunately not. I have skied the area before, more than 5 years ago. This was a very different kind of ski trip. So we'd go up in the morning. You can either take the cable car from Champoluc or just a little bit further down the valley. There's another village called Frachet, and there's a pretty cool funicular that you can get up. And then at the top of both, there's a little plateau with really nice Italian restaurants serving, you know, proper mountain food. There's a peace basher that's turned into a bar that you get like good drinks and snacks at as well. So they're good bases, but definitely intermediate plus skiers in my experience. I didn't get a chance to do the free ride, but I didn't have enough time.
And you mentioned all of those restaurants, and the snow groomer one sounds really good. I think one of the strong reasons for going to Italy in general is the value and the cuisine as well. Is that something that you found on your trip there?
Yes, definitely. I mean, so down in the town, it's a real mountain town. You know, all the shops are ski focused. There's no clothes shops unless you want ski kit. The accommodation is great there. I think I get the idea that it used to be a big British destination. So lots of tour operators used to go there. And I don't know what's happened to that market. I think it was like, serious British skiers used to go there. But now I got the idea that there was only one Ingham's hotel, but lots of really great accommodation, like lots of four stars with really friendly staff and great food.
It may be that there used to be more British skiers going to Champoluc. I think there still is a British tour operator, apart from the big ones, called Ski Champoluc. But there used to be an operator called Ski 2, if I recall correctly. And I think COVID put them out of business, so that may have reduced the number of people. But, you know, for many people listening to this episode, the idea that there aren't particularly many English speakers there would be a bit of a bonus. As it goes, regular listeners might recall our equipment expert Al Morgan reported from the SIGB ski test, and that was held in Champoluc in January, and it will be returning there next year. And that doesn't mean there's going to be a whole load of British skiers there, but it does mean that they have found that the resort is a really good base for testing the skis. And is that something that either of you two go along to, the SIGB ski test?
Yes, I missed last year's, but I've been to La Clusa previously. Did it used to be held in the Italian Alps as well?
Yeah, I mean, it was in Pila in the Aosta Valley before. It's been in La Clusa. It's moved around. It was over in Kutai, I recall, before that. Tris, have you been out to the ski test, or might you be in Champoluc?
I haven't been to the SIGB ski test. I've heard amazing things about it. Yeah, as far as I'm aware, it's mostly ski focused, and I am a snowboarder. I've never learned to ski, unfortunately, for my sins. But yeah, it makes a whole lot of sense to base it in Italy, because as a proud Italian resident married to an Italian, I will always sing the praise of Italy as a ski destination over the other Alpine nations.
Well, that is brilliant, Katie. Thanks very much for that. I'm really pleased to hear that your first two family ski holidays went well. As someone who's been through many of them, I can tell you that evidently, as the ability of your children to ski gets better, it becomes more and more fun. I recently skied with my kids after they've done their season, and worryingly, they're far too fast for me now. They're not quite as good on the off piece, but that will probably come as well. Tris, I wonder if I could turn back to you. I know you like an unusual destination, Tris. Back in episode 165, we mentioned your piece that you wrote about Uzbekistan a few years ago. I know it helps when you're a journalist, but tell me, how did the trip to Albania come up?
Yeah, this was actually off the back of another trip. I had been to visit a new cat skiing operation in Kosovo in 2022, I think, 2021 or 2022, for a story I wrote for the Financial Times. And while I was there, I got on quite well with the founder, a guy called Seb Fleiss, who's an ex-pro from Croatia. So he used to compete on the sort of former Yugoslav snowboard circuit and ride in Austria and various things back in the 90s and early 2000s. And he mentioned that he'd also just co-founded a heli skiing business across the border in Albania. And so my ears pricked up. I thought, well, that sounds like an interesting story. Anyway, a couple of years passed and he got in touch with me. And he basically said, look, we'd love to have you out as a journalist. There's space for the week.
Fantastic. And when was that trip then?
So this was February 2025.
Just to tackle some of the basics, I mean, I don't want to patronize our listeners, but some of them might not be 100% sure where Albania is. So maybe we could start off with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's not one of those that you kind of instantly can point out on a map of Europe necessarily. So the best way to think of it is it's on the Adriatic and it's basically just opposite the heel of the boot of Italy, if that makes sense. So the other side of the Adriatic Sea. So south from Croatia, there's a little bit of Montenegro's coast between the two, but then it's Albania. And then beneath Albania, you have Greece.
You know, historically, Albania was cut off from the rest of the world for many years.
Yeah, absolutely. So they had 40 years under a brutal communist dictator called Enver Hoxha. After he died in 1985, the regime kind of kept going for a little bit up into the 90s and was sort of brutally repressive. So Hoxha is perhaps most famous for his love of Stalinist style purges. So he used to kind of regularly kill off members of his own government and people at the top of the party or send them to horrific prison camps.
And you can see really from what you're saying there why Albania, you know, was not a tourist destination for many years, despite I think I'm right in saying bizarrely that one of his other great loves was Norman Wisdom.
Yeah, I mean, like all sort of dictators, he had his weird quirk. Culturally, he kind of cut the country off almost completely from the rest of the world, including after falling out with the Soviets and other communist countries like Yugoslavia to the north, even from sort of socialist culture. But he had this obsession with the films of Norman Wisdom. The only explanation I've heard is that they show the triumph of a kind of plucky, working class, you know, cheeky chappy getting won over his nasty capitalist boss. But I think he just had a sort of weird sense of humour. So they were the only Western films that were allowed to be shown in Albania, apparently.
I mean, that's bizarre. And I think, you know, over half of our listeners are in the UK. But my guess is that many of them won't have heard of Norman Wisdom. Maybe I'll put a link in the show notes, but for those of you around the rest of the world as well. But so we understand now why Albania doesn't have this really long history of tourism. And I guess that is one of the attractions of it. So to get to the area where you would go heli skiing, it is quite wilderness, but it's certainly not really well connected by local infrastructure. How would you get there?
So you could fly to Tirana, which is the capital of Albania, or you could fly, as I did, to Pristina in Kosovo. Tirana is about a 4.5-hour drive. Pristina is actually a bit closer, 3 hours, and then you have to cross that border. And Pristina is actually... it's worth spending a couple of hours exploring. It's a nice little city. One of its quirks is because of the role that NATO had in helping Kosovo become an independent nation, they've erected statues to both Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, and they've named one of their central squares after Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State at the time. So, yeah, so that's quite a fun little tourist game going around and finding the statue. I think they must be the only country in the world that still loves Tony Blair.
that could be right. So from there, from Pristina, 3 hours, and that takes you into, I think I'm right in saying, like the Valbona Valley, is that right?
Exactly. So you drive then for about 3 hours, crossing the border, over a sort of fairly lowish pass. And then you get into northeastern Albania and you go up where Heliski Albania's base is and where their kind of permit covers is an area of the Valbona Valley National Park, which is this vast kind of wilderness area in northeastern Albania, bordering on Kosovo and Montenegro to the north. Yeah, it really feels remote. The other thing that region is famous for, if you've ever seen the Liam Neeson film Taken, where he has to go and rescue his daughter using his sort of secret service skills, the gangsters who kidnap his daughter are from the Valbona Valley area, basically. And there's some sort of ring of the filmmakers haven't plucked this out of thin air. There was basically a period in the 90s when this was very much the Badlands and produced some of Europe's, I want to say top, that's the wrong word, but top international drug smugglers and some fairly violent Albanian mafia families came from there.
Yeah, so basically it's not really sounding like this is a family holiday, but it is a heli-ski trip. But you know, on top of all of that, I think the area that you are heli-skiing in is called, well, in translation, the Accursed Mountains. Didn't that make you slightly nervous?
Right, I mean, all of these things have sort of added up to make it sound a deeply unappealing place. Yeah, but actually it's kind of wonderful and very welcoming, and Albania has been on various kind of lists of best destinations to visit in Europe in summer and in recent years. Winter tourism, as you said, is that there's obviously a lot less of it, but it's a great place to go. The name of the mountains for me was more of a draw actually than off-putting. Mm-hmm. There are various theories about how the name came about, one involving some soldiers getting lost and dying in the snow. One claims that the devil himself created the mountains. But, you know, all of these are kind of myths of the distant past. I don't think anyone's claiming that they're cursed or accursed now.
Right. Well, let's move on to the heli skiing itself then. So let's clarify as well that, you know, with heli skiing, you don't need to jump out of the helicopter. I think the opening credits of Ski Sunday have kind of misled people on that over a few years. But, you know, with the drop offs, you do need to exit kind of quickly, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it depends on the drop off. And actually, on one of the drops we had on this trip, we did actually jump a couple of feet down into the snow because there'd been a lot of fresh snow. And the pilot, who was absolutely brilliant, this German guy, just said very calmly, he was like, well, I don't know exactly what's underneath, so I'm just going to kind of hover with the tips of my skis touching the snow, the tips of the heli kind of skids touching the snow, and you guys can jump out. But then there were other occasions where he put the chopper fully down and, you know, switched off the engine and got out himself, and you kind of take your time to exit.
Oh, and you with an operator called Heliski Albania then. So how does it work in practice? Are there small groups? Is it a fixed amount of flights or a fixed amount of vertical, which is sometimes how they operate in Alaska or BC?
So, yeah, lots of operations do vertical and a kind of guaranteed vertical feet. I think this is more common in North American operations. I've not been heliskiing in North America, more so pity, but with Heliski Albania, what they do is they charge for rota hours. So basically you're paying for the amount of time that the helicopter's in the air, and the amount of time that the helicopter's in the air for your group depends a bit on how fast you are, how big the group is, how many runs you want to kind of fit in. So they see that as a fairer way of doing things. And normally they'd try and have it with three guides. They'd try and have multiple groups. So you'd have the heli dropping off one group as they ski down, going and picking up another group, dropping them on a different peak so they get fresh lines, then going and meeting the first group, taking them to another peak, kind of in rotation.
Fantastic. And so I guess the key question is then, you know, you've gone to Albania, you've worked your way to this area. What is the terrain and the snow like?
To look at visually, it actually reminded me a lot of the Dolomites where I lived. Like, there's a lot of similarities in the mountains in that Valbona Valley area. You have these enormous kind of rocky cliffs, and the three guides are all pretty serious climbers, and they were in absolute raptures and actually spent downtime kind of just scoping around for climbing routes. Where we were skiing was kind of above those cliffs, and there you have really everything you could want. Kind of big wide open bowls, steep chutes, bits with rocky drop-offs, kind of gullies, all this kind of thing, and really visually stunning. I don't know what I was expecting from Albanian mountains, but I was blown away. I thought they were amazing.
Fantastic. And I think, you know, my understanding is the theory is it has a very good snow record because that snow comes in over the Adriatic. And actually, their cumulative snowfall over the winter is extremely high.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it can be. They have basically absolutely insane winters where they get sometimes as much snow as kind of Niseko in Japan. Seb Fleiss, the guy who runs Heliski Albania, told me they've had winters where they've had 15 meters of cumulative snowfall, which puts it on a par with Niseko. I don't think that happens every winter. And I think because of the proximity to the Adriatic, you do get pretty good consistent snow. It's not always Japanese levels, but they do have an enviable snow record. I think you'd find because it's further south than the Alps, their season's a bit shorter. But the snow, if you go in the season that they run the heliski trips for, which is basically February and March, then you've got a really good chance of getting fantastic snow.
Oh, and then, you know, crunch question then. It sounds like it's going to be the trip of a lifetime, but how much is a trip like this going to set you back?
For next season, it's €9,800 per person for a week. And that includes your rota time and a week's worth of accommodation in a very comfortable hotel and all your meals. And yeah, it's not cheap. I mean, heli skiing is very rich person's niche of what's already a fairly wealthy person's sport, isn't it?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, heli skiing is a trip that is on lots of people's bucket lists. It's not something that I would do now. I have been heli skiing before, only on a single day in Bakira and also a single day in Alanya. That actually the time you mentioned, Katie, how you can access the Monte Rosa and get up to kind of 4,000 plus meters. However, you know, I completely understand how for some people, you know, that is a trip of a lifetime that they're waiting to do. And Albania now comes into the equation. You know, you don't necessarily
need
flying over and taking on the jet lag possibly that you might get with some of the other destinations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very much a kind of wild frontier in the vein of how bits of Canada or the US feel. It's not quite as unpopulated as Canadian wilderness, but it's just there in Europe. And the other thing I think to point out is that tourism is really benefiting Albania. Yeah, the local populations are really benefiting from tourist dollars. And so if you're going to spend the kind of money it costs to go heli skiing, I would recommend going to a locally run operation in a country like Albania.
Oh, well, that is really nicely summarised, Tris. Thank you. There is an article that you have written for the National Geographic magazine. I'll put a link into the show notes for that. You know, really enjoyed reading that, and it gives you a brilliant feel for what it's like. Hopefully our conversation just now has too. Right, we're moving towards a close now. I love getting feedback from our listeners. Let me know what you've enjoyed so far, or if you have ideas for future features. You can leave a comment on Spotify, Instagram or Facebook. Our handle is @SkiPodcast, or drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. We're also on WhatsApp, where I release exclusive material ahead of each episode there, so you can look in the show notes for that link. We have had some feedback since our last episode. Anon, no name, on Spotify said episode 309 was another great episode, bringing the mountains closer to all of us. Despite living in a ski resort myself, is Morja, I never fail to learn something new about life in my own backyard. Lucy Kings, she said, I've been an avid listener for some time. I'm particularly interested in your commitment to sustainable travel, championing the female voice. And above all, I love that the Ski Podcast has highlighted the issues of disability and improving access for skiing for young people by fundraising for Snow Camp. So thanks for that, Lucy. And Antonia Simpson said, I was delighted to see Var and Razul included in episode 310. We've been going to that area for years. It's massively underrated. It's brilliant. And she also mentions that anyone in the area should also look at Les Ors, Réalon, Keras, and Puy-Saint-Vincent. She also points out that while Marseille is the best airport, don't forget the train, which serves Var via Briançon. There are now 311 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. I had a look at the stats this morning, and it's amazing, really, but 235 of those episodes have been listened to in the last week. Maybe that's because the season is pretty much over. Maybe some of our listeners want to keep their snow fix going through the off-season. Well, the good news is we have over 300 episodes in that back catalogue, all available at skipodcast.com. So just have a look around the tags and categories. You're bound to find something of interest to keep you going to next winter. I can also tell you the stats show that the Ski Podcast is listened to all around the world. The majority of our listeners are in the UK, 15% in the States. Everyone else spread as far and wide as, in the last week, Indonesia, Colombia. And I also noticed we have two listeners in Albania. So hopefully both of you will enjoy this episode in particular. That's it for this week. The Ski Podcast will be back soon with a special interview. You're not going to want to miss this one. So make sure you subscribe or follow us now. You may have noticed there's no sponsor message in this week's podcast. So until I find a new sponsor, all these episodes are strictly a labour of love for me. So if you do enjoy the podcast and you want to help out, you're very welcome to buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/theskipodcast. Or even better, if you have an idea for a sponsor for next winter, drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. Right now, I would like to thank my guests for today. Katie, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
And Tris, thank you very much.
Likewise, thanks for having me back in.
And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.